session number 20457, relay team.
Brigadier Randall, relay team.
You were mentioning the experiment with the mortars and the elephants, and you said that the Gurkhas took them over from you. Did you ever hear from the Gurkhas how they got on with them?
Well, only because the company commander, Tom Boyes, was an old chum of mine. He'd been adjutant when I'd been adjutant. And he happened to live down in the West Country. And I remember we met at a dinner party. It was about 40 years later. I said, yes. How'd you get on with those elephants? And he said, you bugger, you know, you didn't half land those elephants with me. I never did really hear... Really, no. I think they came to the conclusion that the mortar was not going to be really much good because it really couldn't do anything which guns couldn't do. Well, at this stage, of course, the atom bomb hadn't dropped, and they were very sensibly looking at all the sorts of weapons that might or might not be useful in a prolonged war right through the rest of Southeast Asia. So, I mean, unless you try these things out, you don't know. So, I mean, at the time, I was sort of bolshy, but looking back now, I think it was a thoroughly sound thing to do to try it out, and even with elephant necessary. So, I mean, with the years go by, you get a bit more wisdom, you get a slightly wider perspective, a rather narrow one you have at the time.
Did you at that time have any expectations about how long the war was likely to last and what course it was likely to take, whether you would have to fight your way through?
Well, we thought we were going to go on and on and on. And we were wearing a bit thin by then. I mean, I'd been in Burma since the beginning. I mean, if my CO had said to me, look, John, I think you've earned a rest. Well, I mean, even before we went back in, if he'd said, I think you've earned a rest, go back to the depot or back, I would have taken it. But I wasn't going to ask for it. But he more or less said, your experience, you know the men know you, you know Burma, can you stick her on? Well, you can't, it's rather difficult to say, well, no. Put your hand up and say, I've had enough. But certainly about that. We then had a new brigadier came. He'd actually been commanding the Probyn's horse.
Yes.
Very gallant, thrusting chap.
Cavalry mentality.
Absolutely. And then after this battle of the breakthrough, really, sometime about the time that the atom bomb was dropped,
yes.
The whole division moved south onto the lower Sitang.
You're saying that you were getting a bit weary, and having been in Burma for such a long period.
Yes.
Do you think everyone felt like that? Was this a sort of general feeling within the battalion?
Well, no, because not everybody had been.
Mm.
There was one other officer who'd been in the battalion at the same time, but he was an Indian, a very good chap, but he'd missed the Imphal fighting because he'd long planned his wedding, and so he missed that. I was the only officer who'd been with it right the way through from start. But there was another chap who'd been through nearly all of it. It wasn't a thing you really talked about much. It was just an inner feeling, really. But I mean, none of us. You see, we down on the Sitang, we had this brigadier who said, "I want vigorous patrolling, and you'll go out and do aggressive patrolling." Well, we so happened that we had an Indian CO who never actually came up and saw the companies. So we kind of commanders sort of amongst ourselves more or less agreed that we were getting a bit bolshy. that we weren't, we were going to hold our ground. I mean, say we were going to do that. We were going to hold our ground and all the rest of it and be proper soldiers. But at that stage, we weren't going to start risking men's lives when it really didn't seem to be very necessary. And as the brigadier and the CO never came up, we got away with it, really. And well, it's not a situation I'm particularly proud of now, but the fact remains that, I'm not unproud of it, because I just don't think that closing once the bomb had dropped, we realised it might be all over. I just didn't feel I wanted to go and chuck men's lives away on aggressive patrolling just for its own sake.
Looking for trouble?
But no, we held our position.
What about the soldiers? I mean, were any of them showing signs of wearing a bit thin or losing their enthusiasm?
I think some of them were getting a bit. See, the brigadier was planning a direct river, assault river crossing of the Sitang. Well, again, we didn't view this with a great deal of enthusiasm. He said, "Oh, the Japanese are finished, and there'd be no sort of thing." Well, we didn't entirely go along with it. And later on, we actually, when after the surrender, we met. When we come to it, that we discovered that the brigadier was wrong, and that the Japanese had been reinforced, and they would have given us a bloody nose. Anybody's endurance, it can't go on forever. I don't mean to say our morale wasn't low at all, our discipline, all that sort of thing. We maintained our weapon. I don't mean to say we were getting that, but we weren't thirsting to go assaulting Japanese on and on and on, right across rest of Burma, across Siam, across, you know. I mean, it looked a bit of an endless prospect, frankly, till the bomb came.
It sounds as though you'd become old soldiers, effectively.
Yeah, I'm afraid we had.
Yeah. Well, old soldiers bring to their occupation, they bring experience and skill, don't they? You might say that there's a counterbalance, that as the reckless enthusiasm of young soldiers and new soldiers decline. So what they lose in enthusiasm and recklessness, they gain in skill and experience.
Well, that's the balance, yes. Mm. Yeah.
How was news of the bomb greeted? What was the feeling in the company?
Well, my company was up defending the gun box. The divisional gun box. And for once, I was eating European food. I'd been living, I adapted, and I went into the gunner mess, and I remember the adjutant of the gunners, whose name was John something. He said, "Morning, John." I said, "Morning, John." He said, "Heard the news." I said, "What news?" He said, "Oh, the Yanks have dropped a massive bomb, 10,000 tons." And I said, "Well, that sounds good news." And we all bit sceptical. Perhaps it's just one of these newspaper hypes and so on. Then we heard they dropped another one, and then we began to realise that this was something right outside all our normal experience of warfare. The full significance didn't really appear, but I mean, it sounded good news.
Did it eventually sink in, the significance of what had happened?
Well, then gradually we began to hear the Japanese were thinking of surrendering, the war was coming to an end. But quite rightly, our master said, you know, we mustn't relax our grip, and so we continued patrolling and that sort of thing. And then the division, just about a week after the Japanese, after the bomb, the division moved south, and then again we were dug in and patrolling, but once the prospect of the Japanese surrendering appeared on the horizon, We began to take a slightly sort of alekhesic view, you know, we're not going to stick our neck over the parapet unless we have to. Well, that may or may not be a good thing, but I think it was a sensible one, actually.
It's probably an inevitable thing.
I think so. You know, I think it's only human nature that if there's no music, you go on doing what you have to do. But if you suddenly realise that you might just actually survive the war, then you cannot. Your attitude must change. And I think you owe it to your men to treat them in the same way. And nothing that worries my conscience now, the fact that I didn't obey the brigadier's orders about aggressive patrolling.
What happened then when the Japanese did surrender? What was the impact of that?
Well, then the VJAG day came.
Yes.
And we were in the line, bloody awful wet place on the banks of, near the banks of the city. Rain pissing down, and then there was a terrific sort of feu de joie. Everybody, we had some captured Japanese medium machine guns. We fired them. Everybody was firing a sort of feu de joie. The guns were firing star shells and all the rest of it. It was a hell of a thing. And then brigade headquarters said, "What's going on? What are you firing at? And what's all this fire about?" And I got the message from battalion quarters, "Brigade want to know what you're firing at." And all I said was, "What fire?" I was getting a bit bossy. Anyway, and then we settled down. Then I was able to move my company into a Buddhist monastery. Which is quite nice because we were out of the rain and stuff, and that was quite interesting. These Buddhist monks viewed us with some apprehension at first, but I kept a pretty tight hand on my chaps, and I said there's going to be no messing about, damaging or nicking anything, and I got on quite well with the monks. In fact, they presented me with a Buddha in a box. You know, you used to have sailing ships. I've got somewhere upstairs this Buddha in a whiskey bottle as a sort of memento for the fact that we had behaved properly there. We did quite a bit of fishing with grenades in the river, which produced us a good supply of fresh fish. And then we were ordered then to go down and cross the Satang by ferry, which had been put up. And the ferry was right by the bridge, which had been blown up in February 40. And it was slightly poignant to be actually crossing over by the bridge. We'd been just about the last unit to come. And then we went to a place called Chaito, where we were ordered to arrange the surrender of the, I think it was the 18th Japanese Division. The CO went off on compassionate leave, and somebody else went. Anyway, the second in command became acting CO, and I was the next senior guy, was acting second in command. And the orders, the Japanese division, the brigade commander sent a message to the whole of this Japanese division was pushed into the bush near Chaito. And we were then told to arrange to disarm them.
How did you make contact with them initially?
Well, the acting CO, a chap called Brian von D. Harding, his grandmother being a German baroness or something. Anyway, he was always known as the Baron. He and I and the adjutant decided we would go up, so we drove up. We sent some sort of message we were coming. And we drove up right into the... And we got out of our Land Rover, and all of a sudden, a whole lot of Japs came rushing down the hill with fixed bayonets. And I thought, Christ, the buggers are going to see. In fact, it was a Japanese sort of quarter guard falling in. There was only one chap who could speak English. He was rather a sort of oily chap who, I think he was at Chicago University. Anyway, he sort of ushered us in. And to the divisional headquarters, where the Japanese divisional commander was, and we sort of shook hands, and there were strong orders against fraternization. Well, we weren't very keen on fraternizing anyway, but we took the view that this was not a time for arrogant triumphalism, that we should set them an example as to how a civilized race treated its conquered, and not the arrogant way that the Japanese did. So we believed in firmness, but not sort of arrogance. Anyway, we sat down and we said, "Well, right. Well, we want you to hand in all your weapons." We tell them where it was, a big godown at Chaito railway station. And we gave them the general order in which it was to be done, a program of where, and we discussed this, and we said we want a complete list in English of all the, so many guns and so on, you will do this, we said so many days, and this, we discussed it. They said, well, it might be a bit... Anyway, we then agreed on a plan. And then they suddenly said, what about our swords? And we never thought about this. Because, as you know, the officer's sword is the emblem of their personal honour. So I remember looking at Brian, and he said, we said, well, we'll adjourn for a moment. We went out and said, oh, Christ, what are we going to do about these swords? It was quite, they wanted to hand them in personally. We have other visions, you know, they'd just be dumped like the rest of them. But anyway, we then came to the conclusion that probably it would, to treat them in a civilized fashion over their swords would probably mean that they cooperated more. So we went back and said, right, well, provided that all the equipment is handed in, at the very end, we will arrange for you to each officer of the division to hand his sword in an honourable fashion, and we will accept him in an honourable fashion, except the divisional commander will hand his sword to brigade commander. And they were visibly pleased about this. And so, indeed, they did. They did it. They handed everything. Their discipline and efficiency was absolutely first class. And we did have this big parade. Sia was still away, so the second in command. So we took it in turns. He did about an hour. And then the rest of us did our stint. And each Japanese officer came up and saluted, and then took his, unsheathed his sword, handed it over, and it all went on. And then there was a pile where we put them. But just in case, we had about six or seven crack Tommy gunners standing by, with one up the spout and safety catch off. And we've got a proper drill worked out, just in case some Jap officer might suddenly have decided to whip his sword out and go to his death hacking a British officer's head off. Anyway, it all went off. We heard afterwards that the Japanese were immensely grateful to us. They actually said, you know, that we were very much surprised and pleased that how well you treated us. And I think, looking back, I think that was the right thing, really. We obviously could have rubbed their nose in all sorts of ways, but it seemed to us that we should set an example of...
What happened to them after they'd paraded to hand over weapons?
Well, then,
weapons?
You see, each company was given a platoon of Japs for fatigue. Yes. My soldiers got bloody fat and idle, because any sort of fatigue you wanted, digging latrines or something like that, the Japs did it. And then the brigade challenged us to a cricket match, and we had about 300 Japanese rolling the cricket crown with a bloody great roller. And so the Japanese provided all the sort of fatigue parties and things. They came in every day. I don't quite know how it worked out.
Where were they kept? Were they in a...
Well, they were out in there. You see, they still remain... They weren't in a... In a they still remain under the command of their own officers in their own area.
They weren't in a POW cage.
No. And we provided... rations, obviously, and medical drugs, and the bare necessities, and they'd picked a spot where there was water, and I think if there was any illness and things, but they remained in their own, under their own officer's command. It worked quite well. It worked surprisingly well, really.
What sort of rations did you give them? Did you give?
I don't know. I don't know because
didn't affect you.
They came. The quartermaster dealt with all that. I don't know. We never went up. I never went up again.
When they were doing this fatigue work, did they do so willingly and thoroughly?
Oh yeah, very well. But when we went up that first time, I mean, the divisional commander, when that was there, he said, would you care to come and have a drink? Well, we weren't supposed to, but we thought, well... So we went into their sort of, I suppose, sort of ops headquarters, and we drank some sake, and then we said, well, now, you were facing us on the sitang, can you... So they produced all their maps and so on and explained their plan. It was quickly obvious to us that... If we had followed the brigade commander's plan, we would have been absolutely slaughtered because this division had been heavily reinforced from somewhere, from Thailand or somewhere, and they weren't just a band of defeated chaps. They were already they would have given us quite a hard time. There's no doubt about that. But it was a strange experience, really.
Was their defensive position laid out in the same sort of way as you would have laid it out if you'd been in their position?
I really can't answer. I can't remember now. Mm. I think that they were going to hold. I mean, there are two ways of holding a river, as you know. You either hold right forward and try and defeat the assaulting people on the. In the water, as it were, or you hold the banks lightly, and then hold your main force back until you know which way whereabouts they're going to assault, and then you launch a counterattack. I mean, those are the two sort of basic ways of holding a river line. I can't remember now, except it looked a very efficient plan, and knowing where we were going to assault, they'd got it about right. That's about as much as I can remember now, really. We didn't spend an awful lot of time on it. We weren't supposed to be fraternising, but I mean, nobody was going to know. And it didn't seem to be doing anything very... it wasn't disobeying. It was really, to some extent, getting in a cooperative frame of mind. But we didn't know what their attitude was going to be. And it seemed that within reason to... get their cooperation was a sensible thing to do.
Was their headquarters, their ops room, laid out in a similar way to yours?
Yes, basically it was, yes. They tend to do the German... If you ever look at pictures of British generals always having maps up, hanging on walls or on blackboards and things. If you ever look at any pictures of the Germans, they're always absolutely flat. This is a phenomenon, I don't quite know why. And the Japanese, I think, adapted the German practice, having all their maps always flat.
Spread on tables.
Mm. Mm. I don't know why, but you'll never see Germans ever. You can look at any pictures of any Germans in the First World War, Second World War, they're always flat.
Do you remember what sort of marking they'd use on their maps? Because we tended to use Chinagraph and Talc, didn't we, with an overlay?
Yes.
Did they have the same system?
Do you know? I really can't remember now. I don't recall having sort of overlays and things.
What was the demeanour of this man, this divisional commander, when you?
He was quite a short chap. He was quite dignified. I have to admit that we came to admire the Japanese really for the general way they behaved at a time which must have been of considerable shame and, to them. That they behaved with great dignity, I thought. They were neither difficult nor were they obsequious. I thought that they really behaved. We were quite surprised at their discipline. See, funnily enough, the battalion of Gurkhas in our brigade went to the place at Parn. You know, where our very first battle was on. Why our CO didn't ask for us to go there, so we finished up where we'd started, I don't know. But anyway, but the Gurkhas did have a guest night in November, and they did. They asked a couple of our officers, and the CO sent me and a chap called Siri Kunt, who got his DSO at Parn, and we went to the guest night, and we stayed the night, and as we walked into their mess that night, the CO of the Gurkhas said, to me, or to Siri and me, he said, I know what you chaps and your battalion suffered here nearly 4 years ago. There are 1,000 Japanese standing out in the rain. It was a bit of rain then. They're standing there, they'll stand there at attention until you care to give the order to dismiss them. Well, I was slightly uneasy about this, but anyway, the Gurkhas had done it as a special compliment to us, so we had two or three drinks, and then just before we went into dinner, I think we said, well, perhaps you'd better dismiss those chaps. And I was talking to the Gurkhas afterwards, and I said, what attitude did they... How did you explain this to the Japanese? Oh, we said, we told them. They said that we've got two officers coming here, were seen off by you in 1942, just so they will know that they'll feel happy about it. You'll provide 1,000 chaps. The Japanese thought this is absolutely right. They said, well, yes, quite right, you know, we don't object this. And apparently they all stood, every single chap stood there for 3/4 of an hour, the rain pouring down, absolutely rock still. You know, you had to admire them in some sort of strange way. Anyway, it all went very well, really, the handover. And then just when we were sort of settling down, you know, everybody getting a decent night's sleep and not much military activity, a lot of parties, a lot of football games, the dacoit started up, which was a bloody nuisance.
Do you have any sort of general thoughts about the campaign in Burma, which had come to an end, and any ideas about what lessons were learned, a sort of general summing up?
Yes, I mean, I think it's the old age, one of the lessons I learned is that despite all modern technology of every possible sort, it is the quality of the human spirit which in the end decides what the fundamental issues of life. And I shall go on believing that to my dying day. And we were particularly fortunate, I think, that the system produced Bill Slim, my great hero, but a man of his all-round military qualities of leadership, I think that was probably the biggest single factor. We did go from half-trained, raw, green soldiers to at the end. I mean, the battalion at the end was reckoned to be one of the best battalions in the 17th Indian Division. It was just about the best division in Burma. We did go from from very, very raw to we were absolutely, I say it in no sense of arrogance, I mean, as a very top-class battalion at the end. I mean, there was nothing we couldn't have done, really. I mean, we were